welcome everybody, and thank you for taking the time to be here this evening to listen to us. Bert and I are going to talk a little bit about the events that have happened over the past 24 hours in Mojave. While Oshkosh was getting underway on Monday, we rolled out the White Knight 2. And it's a fantastic moment for everybody on both the Virgin Galactic and the Scale teams that we've now got to the tangibility of actually producing a vehicle. Bert will be talking to you about the vehicle at a bit of length later on. I thought the first thing we'd do, though, is just show you a little snapshot of footage from the rollout yesterday. So as you can see, that White Knight 2 is real, and this isn't a Capricorn 1 moment. Obviously, Virgin Galactic was formed in 2004 at the time that the XPRIZE winning flights were taking place in Mojave. And Bert and the team, obviously, having built Spaceship One, signed an agreement with Virgin Galactic to embark upon the both research and development project for Spaceship Two and White Knight 2. But this was a slightly different project. It was a project to actually produce commercial vehicles capable of taking people into space. And the vehicles that we've produced over the last 4 years really do look quite spectacular. Hopefully you'll be able to see them in a couple of minutes. But one of the really exciting things about the system and the vehicles is that they're doing for the visionary pioneers who have already put their deposits down for space tourism. We've got about 270 astronauts now signed up and $37 million in deposits. Sadly, the $37 million in deposits don't quite match the $100 million we've had to spend developing the first vehicles, but they are proof of the tangibility of the vision that people have of manned, regularized, safe human spaceflight. Now, one of the really exciting things about the project as well is that the customers told us while we were researching the project at the very beginning that one of the things they most wanted to experience was weightlessness. Now that was great because it set us a challenge of building a spaceship big enough to allow them to move freely around in the cabin. And Bert has achieved that. But that's also allowed us to build a White Knight 2 capable of carrying a higher payload than just the spaceship. The White Knight 2 has a capability to carry, for instance, an unmanned launch vehicle up to 50,000 feet to be launched, which could launch a 100-kilogram low Earth orbit satellite. It's also given us the capability in the White Knight 2 to not only take people into space who want to see that vision of the blue planet, the thin atmosphere, the blackness of space, and experience that weightlessness, but it will also allow us to carry scientists up there, for example, who can do microgravity experiments live rather than have to send them up on unmanned sounding rockets. So the request that the customers had to experience real weightlessness has given us the excuse to build a vehicle which really does have a multi-purpose number of roles. And White Knight 2 is a really amazing aircraft. And I'm not going to say too much more about it now because Bert will be telling you about that, but it does have a 0-6G capability and a training capability that we'll go into as well in a little bit of depth later on. But the really also very exciting thing about the project is seeing White Knight 2 for the first time finished. It is a unique aircraft. It is 100% carbon composite. Bert's put a lot of innovation into it, which he'll be telling you about shortly as well. But if all aircraft were built this way in commercial aviation in the United States at the moment, then we'd have aircraft that would be using roughly 50% less fuel than they do today. And Boeing and Airbus, the two prime manufacturers in the commercial aviation sector, are moving with composites, but they're not moving that quickly. We still don't have a 100% composite large commercial aircraft capable of carrying people around the country. And as I say, if we did, we'd not only have much lower fuel bills and much less emissions, but we'd also have a situation whereby the ticket prices wouldn't be soaring to the extent that they are at the moment. So I think White Knight 2 does represent, really for the big prime manufacturers, a challenge. We're going to regularize flying with the White Knight 2 system and prove quite conclusively, I'm very confident to say, that you know it is not difficult to build 100% composite aircraft on a large scale. And that's going to be a challenge to this industry, the aviation industry I'm talking about, to wake up and start moving faster than we've moved so far with the A380 and the 787.
The utilization of space is essential not only for communications, but also for the logistics of survival through things such as weather satellites, agricultural monitoring, GPS, and climate science.
The beauty about this configuration is we can, with this airplane, go out and launch a light satellite orbital boosters that are flyback reusable boosters.
This is about going to space, seeing the beauty of the planet Earth, seeing the real curvature of the Earth, seeing the atmosphere, and also experiencing true weightlessness for a period of time. Now, this is the White Knight 2 itself in the hangar, just before the rollout. As you can see, this open architecture, which you probably heard Bert and myself speak about before, is really very visible here. It gives us the flexibility with this design to literally put any payload under there that we want to put. And I think the aircraft will be capable of being used in the atmosphere for payload work as well.
To give you an idea how big the airplane is, its wingspan is the same as a B-29, the world's the World War II's largest bomber. Same wingspan, four engines. The engines are placed outboard so that we can clear up that payload area to put any type of payload that doesn't have issues with integrating it with the turbofan engines. The White Knight 2 has more capability than it needs just to launch Spaceship 2, so it is designed to have some flexibility to do other things that beyond just launching the Spaceship 2. However, flying people in the Spaceship 2 is clearly going to be its largest volume business. Everything else in space launches is tiny business compared to flying you folk. I'm wondering if the folk that are on that rheostat, I didn't bring sunscreen for this evening. Is it possible to turn that down on us just a little bit so we can see who we're talking to? Or you're turning them up, but we're still frying us up here. Yeah. Yeah, that is better. This is the first introduction of real hardware on our commercial suborbital system. It's an airplane we're very proud of. It's an airplane that was developed by a design team headed up by Bob Morgan and Jim Tai, which I think some of you met last year. He's the chief aerodynamist at Scaled. It's a different airplane than I originally laid out. This design team has made a number of very interesting improvements on it by bringing the cockpit and cabin down to a boom rather than up in the center, like in White Knight 2. Clears open that area and also makes it easy to get in and out of the cabin. You see two cabins there. Only one of them has a flight crew. They really don't fight against each other. The flight crew is in the right cabin. The other one can be pressurized and loaded up with people so you can train them on their space flight experience. The cabins of all three of these are identical. If you're a passenger who's going to fly in space tomorrow in the spaceship, if you're flying today in the White Knight, you're in the same seat, you're in the same windows, everything looks the same. And this airplane has the capability of training the passengers for the most critical stages of the space flight. What it will do is a parabolic maneuver where it climbs. It bumps the people into the air, in other words, goes immediately to zero Gs, where they start floating around the cabin. And it lets them float for a while, and then White Knight brings them down ever so gently. And the reason is, on real atmospheric entry during your space flight, you don't hit the atmosphere quickly, you hit it very gently. As the people float towards the floor, it takes another 22 seconds until you're at 1G. And that's quite a bit of time. So it gives you a period in which it's easier to maneuver than it is at 1G. You know, if I'm 65, if I fell down on the floor here, it's a little difficult for me to get up and get on top of the seat and put on my seatbelt for a reentry. But if it's only 2/10 and then 3/10 and 4/10 of a G, these are real easy maneuvers to do. So we want to make sure that the people that are going to be flying to space are comfortable with a scenario of floating about the cabin totally free and then getting into a reclined position for reentry. And the airplane without the payload, in other words, without a spaceship on it, this big airplane is a 7G airplane, not a 2.5 or 3G airplane like other airplanes that look like this. So this is a fully aerobatic airplane from the standpoint is it can go out and pull 7Gs if it doesn't have the payload on. So visualize it pulling up, floating the passengers, bringing them down very gently, and also rolling. Because when you get to 1G, you want to keep that G going. So you get to 1G, and then you're in a dive, and you start pulling, and you take them to 2Gs, which they get at in another 8 seconds or so. And then you pull them to 4Gs. And they spend about 20 seconds above 4Gs. And then you relax that back off and you end up in a 1G level flight. So by properly maneuvering the launch airplane, you can take the people who will be astronauts tomorrow and give them the entire experience of weightless, the reentry, and all the reentry G levels. So it lets us validate that they're used to that environment, they're happy to do it in a real space flight, and it really is a wonderful tool, not just for passenger training, but also for pilot training. The White Knight 2 also, like White Knight 1, has some very effective spoilers. So the big airplane can fly the same speed and glide path angle as a spaceship. Unlike Spaceship 1, Spaceship 2 has spoilers so that you have a throttle. You can fly at a shallow angle or a steep angle. Spaceship One, all we could do is put the landing gear down and then we couldn't put it up again. So we had very little control over our flight path. Spaceship Two, you can fly it on final with what amounts to a throttle because you can give it a higher LVD or a lower LVD. And that same feature and capability will be in the turbofan airplane, so the pilots can practice these dead stick maneuvers. We believe that to satisfy the public's desire to fly these types of suborbital space flights, and to when we build a system that's robust and we fly it a lot, and the costs will come down a lot when we fly it a lot. Out probably third or fourth or fifth year of commercial operations, we'll be flying a spaceship every day. And after that, probably be flying it twice a day. The spaceships are designed to be able to fly 2 space flights per day. And we plan to build between 40 and 50 spaceships. We'll need that to populate the various spaceports around the world that will be operating these, and to be able to fly the folk who want to fly. Our plan to produce the spaceships at this rate will have us producing at the end of a 12-year period after operations start, we'll have 40 to 50 spaceships, and we'll have flown at that time 100,000 people. Now, flying 100,000 people out of the atmosphere, if you say that number to anyone that's involved in space launch, whether they're involved in satellites or Mars probes or GPS or weather or communications or manned space flight, name all of those, and those numbers don't mean anything to them. It's you know, they're used to buying boosters where a booster manufacturer who has many thousands of employees, he may sell 3 or 4 boosters a year. And that's the reason that these things are so costly, is that how many things that you have to build and sell compared to how many thousands of people work for you. That's where the costs are. Now, the operations of these are intended to be very routine and robust and very safe because of their maturity. So, that type of a system now will also mean that the system that we're using to fly this high volume can at very low cost and high reliability be used for other things like small satellite launches or for Earth sensing or for a whole bunch of other missions because it will be a mature, high volume, high flight rate, essentially a certified configuration that supports a lot of flying. The airplane, unlike the unlike the White Knight 2, has type certified turbofan engines that have very long TBOs. They are the Pratt & Whitney 308As. It's a extremely efficient turbofan engine. It's a modern type certified engine. So we expect to have operability much like you have on a common business jet that flies every day. The White Knight 2, once the volume is up and once you have the availability of spaceships, the airplane can launch 3 or 4 space flights a day. And we expect to see that when we're 5th or 6th year into these operations, that this is the kind of flight rates that will be going on. And we believe at the level of cost that this system will level out after a lot of use, that there'll actually be millions of people who can afford and who will want to do this. Now, why do that? Why are we spending all of our efforts right now to fly something that, if you compare to going to the moon or going to the space station, as being not a big technical advance? It's a step backward from the standpoint of difficulty. The reason is it brings to spaceflight something that's never been there before, and that is a lot of maturity, a lot of volume, and thus very low costs, and the high reliability that you get by having maturity. With that, we believe that it'll attract a lot of investment because there will be confidence that it is a low-risk financial investment to go ahead and build orbital systems and resort hotels on orbit and put up the beautiful places and the golf courses and all the kind of neat stuff that you'll want to have on orbit, and the capability to take a shore excursion by looping around the moon. You know, all the fun stuff that we all want to do, I think will come sooner and will be available to the public much sooner because we took the time right now to develop a high use, fly a lot of people, simple suborbital system. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I think it's just worth pointing out that every time the shuttle launches, it costs about $750 million to $800 million a launch. The entire investment in this project by Virgin is going to be around the $300 million mark. We're about $100 million in now. And we would have built a new type of space launch system which gets rid of the first stage of a rocket. Air launch is intrinsically going to be safer than ground-launched rockets are going to be. So it is a technological advance, although we're not going further into space. And the ability to launch 100-kilogram satellites for under $2 million instead of the up to $50 million it can cost today is really important as well. And the ability to take suborbital science to a new level and microgravity experiments to a new level is important because it does send this marker out to the private sector that is worth investing. There's been no private sector investment to speak of in space launch systems. Most of the private sector investment has gone into communication satellites and into other areas. And that's really quite bad news. And I think it's worth just spending a minute to explain why. Space really matters to us now. I do occasionally hear people say, why, when we've got all these problems on planet Earth, do we even bother going to space? And I think it's worth reminding, because I don't think we think about it enough, space. We don't realize that, for example, with the population of the planet, now it's 6.5 billion people. There were 3 billion people when Bert and I were born. 6.5 billion people today. By the time I retire, there's going to be 9 billion people. By the time I die, it looks like there'll be about 11 billion people.
Minus one.
Minus, yeah. Probably minus two by then as well. But that huge level of population currently, that the 6.5 billion level, is only being supported and fed because of space. The combination of the agricultural satellites and the weather satellites that they work with and interlink with, and the GPS system, has meant that farmers all over the world can do much more about the crops that they put down, what fertilizer to put on them, when to cut a crop, because they can see a weather system coming just at the time of harvest. They can then put those crops into containers which have got GPS markers on them, so they don't spoil in ports anymore. We used to lose about 10% of our food because it just got spoiled because the containers got lost somewhere. Now, all of those together have meant we're probably producing over the last decade, with the use of the satellites combined with the GPS system, about 11 to 12% more food than we otherwise would be. So simply to feed ourselves in the future, we're going to need to be in space. Also, if there were cheap ways to get low Earth orbit, small low Earth orbit satellites up there, we could put our server farms in space. We could take a lot of our heat out of the planet that is being produced from the energy that's used for things like IT servers, of which there are now 500 million worldwide. We could also do things like produce solar power in space. It's always been a dream to be able to produce solar power in space from circles of small satellites gathering solar power and bringing it down to the planet. But it's simply been too horrifically expensive to consider the idea. This system itself may not be capable of producing satellite launches would allow us to do that. But my belief is, and Bert's belief is, that this will unlock a wall of private sector money if this project can be proven to be safe and successful in the private sector. And that really does matter a lot. If you look at what happened, for instance, with two military technologies, one was the internet, developed originally by the military. The other one is the mobile phone system we have today. The digital mobile phone system was developed by the military originally. When those technologies were both unlocked and laid free to private sector investment, look at the revolutions that we've had in the communications that we have worldwide. And trillions of dollars have gone into both mobile telephony and internet investment. But actually, space launch systems haven't had very much investment at all. There's been a lot of money spent on space launch systems, but they are all, to speak of, the same as the V2 rocket of 1944, designed by Wernher von Braun, which came to visit London in 1944 and 1945, and was then taken to the United States and taken to the Soviet Union as it was at that time, and developed into bigger rockets. But essentially, the technology of rocketry, ground-based rocketry, has not changed.
The investment's all in development and almost none in research. That's the key. Everyone who's not a big guy, who calculates and estimates that he can build a low-cost launch system, usually finds, when he operates it out of the government sites at Vandenberg or the Cape, that he's shocked at what happened to his estimates. It is said one of the reasons that the space shuttle got so expensive, even in the early days, is it got to Florida way too soon, and all those Apollo guys were still there, and they all wanted jobs. When you, Elon Musk has found this in spades, trying to combine with a government launch site, to the point where he's gone out and bought a portion of an island to do his own launching. Even the big guys are launching off of ships because it's just too expensive to do that. One of the key elements in our approach for suborbital space is to have an entire system that has no requirements for any of the government launch sites. It can operate out of Mojave Airport, and it can operate out of a large number of commercial or private airports. And that means that the folk who are charging to the program and adding to the cost are only exactly what you really need, rather than what you're forced to use. And that's an enormous benefit that we think is going to save an enormous amount of our stress and grief in developing and commercializing this sort of system. We can make our decisions based on common sense safety rather than having to satisfy requirements that may not apply to this system.
Now, we'll take a moment just to tell you a little bit about the experience that the Virgin Galactic astronauts will have. We've got some footage, which hopefully won't take as long to run as the last lot. There's some footage of some of the training that the astronauts are currently going through, which is quite fun to look at. So if we can roll that, please. Talk a little bit over it while we do. We've put 100 of the first 270 astronauts who've actually signed up and paid their deposits through a centrifuge program where they're pulling about 3.5 GZ, and in the centrifuge they pull about 6 GX. Now they'll get about 6 GX, we think, on re-entry and about 3.5 GZ in the climb. And the centrifuge at NASTAR also has a little simulator in it as well. Here it is. This was Richard Branson training for his centrifuge testing with his son Sam Branson. And going through the process, you have a morning's classes where you learn about the effects of gravity on the body. You learn about the various techniques that you can use in your own body to overcome the effects of G-forces. And then after you've gone through that program, you go into this rather fine simulator, which I can assure you is about the best fun I've ever had in my life. And you actually, when you're inside the simulator, you actually see a flight profile for the spaceship flying into space. This is some of the customers, and as you can see, they're very much enjoying the experience.
Notice they all don't look like typical astronauts either.
It's so important to go through that so that when you actually go into space, you can just lie back and enjoy the whole experience. 2 or 3 years from now, I'm going to be in space in absolute reality, and it's just going to be breathtaking.
And Bert's comment about them not looking like typical astronauts is absolutely right. One of the things that we, and I said in the Theatre of the Woods about 3 years ago when this program began and Bert and I were speaking here, I said we hope that about 80% of people would be able to withstand the G-forces and all the other aspects of the experience and fly to space safely. The research program we've undertaken of taking ordinary people, many of them in their 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, in fact, the oldest customer we've spun in that centrifuge was Professor James Lovelock, the inventor of Gaia theory, who is 89 years old, and he was perfectly fine, and he's had a heart bypass operation in the past. The youngest customer we put in so far is Sam Branson, who's 22, and we're about to put a 16-year-old in whose father has just signed him up to go into space, into the centrifuge. What we've experienced with the program of the first 100, and I think it's going to continue as we get the data on the next 250, what we found is actually 94% of human beings of any age are capable of going to space from the point of view of the G-forces and their effects on the body, which is a much higher figure than initially the doctors thought would be the case. But there's never been a program which has just taken ordinary people and put them through this process. There was a bit of a myth created in the early 60s, probably rightly so to some extent. NASA didn't know what the experience of space was going to be like. They didn't necessarily know what the best things to do with people were going to be. They didn't know how long some of the astronauts would be in space for as the program developed. If they were going to the moon, they might be away for days, so they couldn't afford to have them getting sick. But basically, the standards they created at that time, which were very high and rightly so, are actually not the standards that you need for space. As long as you are healthy, you do not need to be particularly fit to go to space. And the only real issue that we've discovered is very severe cardiovascular problems. Very severe cardiovascular problems are a limiter on this. And that's really the sort of 6 to 7% of adults who wouldn't be able to do it. But it's been fantastic with the customers putting them through this centrifuge because they've come out of it and their enthusiasm to get into Spaceship Two and actually go up there and get the one bit of the experience we can't give them in a centrifuge is breathtakingly overwhelming. They just want to get the next bit. And of course, the bit in between, pulling your 3.5 G on the way up and your 6 GX on the way down, is that 0 G bit right up there in the middle. But, you know, if the spaceship is in space, it's feathered, the astronauts are able to float around in that cabin for a number of minutes of pure weightlessness. They'll have windows on all sides of the cabin, so they'll be able to see not only the beautiful blue planet below them and that thin atmosphere we talked about earlier, but they'll also be able to see the blackness of space while they move in that freedom. And for all of them at the moment, most of the customers have also now been on the zero-G aircraft. They've had a little taste of zero-G, because obviously that's a relatively short amount of zero-G you get in the 727. It's about 28 seconds or so, max. So if you're going to get some minutes of weightlessness, it's a completely different experience for people. And I know from talking to Brian Binney and Mike Melville, who obviously didn't experience weightlessness on Spaceship One in the sense they could move around the cabin, they were pretty well strapped in. They said actually the period of weightlessness felt like an awful long time. And, you know, they felt that coming back, they felt they'd had a very, very long, mind-blowing experience. And the total experience our customers will be about 2 hours, roughly, from the time you're climbing into the spaceship. You're climbing the next day's customers into the White Knight. You're taking off from the runway. You've got to make the climb up to about 48 to 50,000 feet. You've got to launch the spaceship, fire the rocket motor. Of course, all of our customers will experience going at nearly 3,000 miles an hour as well, an experience very, very few people have at the moment. 450 people, in fact, it's about 470 people now have been to space. And as Bert said earlier, we're planning to carry at least that number in the year one of the program, and then thousands of people in the years that follow each year. So we will be changing dramatically the entire experience of space.
I want to talk a little bit about another technical issue, and then we're going to open this up for Q&A, because we're not prepared to give a talk tonight, and also because it always works out better to focus on the things that you're interested in rather than what we are guessing you're interested in. And that's always excellent. I want to talk a little bit about why the spaceship goes into this feathered configuration. First of all, I defined it initially because I wanted a super stable shuttlecock-like reentry, and yet I still wanted to glide and land rather than come in by parachutes. Now, having spaceships that are very stable on reentry that don't have to be controlled, that's been around since the very start. The Russian one that flew Gagarin was a sphere with the center gravity off center, so it would point that side forward. The Mercury capsule, the invention by Max Faget, had this big base plate, and the CG was low so that you could throw it at the atmosphere and it would straighten out and not have to be controlled. It's like that. I searched for configurations that would do that, and I found that almost anything will work subsonically, but you re-enter at Mach 3 to 4, so you have to have something that works supersonically. The reason that the feathers on Spaceship 1 and 2 look like this is it merely was the first configuration that I was able to find that does indeed work at all Mach numbers. And here's how it... If this were like a space shuttle or an X-15, it couldn't make a vertical reentry into the atmosphere because the buildup of dynamic pressure would be way too severe, because the drag is relatively low, and like a bullet, you drop way into the atmosphere down to 60,000 feet and then pick up real heavy loads. If you put the feather up, also the X-15 and the shuttle the shuttle enters at a very, very shallow angle, and it decelerates for about 40 minutes at a very shallow angle. The X-15 enters at a 40-degree angle at 40 degrees angle of attack. So it looks like it's flat, but it's actually at 40 degrees angle of attack. And during the reentry, it makes this pull-up to a shallower glide path. And that's how it's able to survive re-entry from over 100 kilometers, even though it goes to a dynamic pressure of about 1,700 psi. That's equivalent to about 850 knots indicated. Spaceship 1 and 2 can re-enter the atmosphere at any angle, straight down if you want to, where these other ones would be destroyed. it can also re-enter the atmosphere at any attitude. So what this means now is you're immune to an accident caused by the flight control. You don't have to re-enter the atmosphere at just the right angle, and you don't have to, or glide path angle is what I'm talking about there, and you don't have to enter the atmosphere at precisely the right angle of attack and sideslip angle. And the only fatal accident in the X-15 program is when it was re-entered in a sideslip, and it coupled, and it broke up, and Mike Adams was killed. I was at Edwards when that happened. That haunted me, and I knew from the outset in putting this program together that I wanted something that would be immune to that type of accident. In other words, something where the pilot doesn't have to control it during reentry. What the pilot does is he just roughly points it at the atmosphere. He does this on the way up. Now we fly the weightless part. He just roughly points it in the direction he's going, and he's out of the loop. If you take the spaceship during reentry and go full forward stick or full aft stick or full side slip, you know, full rudder, both ways, you only change the angle of attack and side slip by a couple degrees out of a 65 degree angle of attack. So essentially the pilot is not in control of the attitude during reentry, and he doesn't have to be in control of the flight path angle in order to make a safe reentry. So it's very robust. Essentially it happens. You can re-enter upside down or sideways, and it will, for a long period of time of about 30 seconds or so, it'll do these big lazy oscillations that are damped, and finally when it's at maximum Q, which is actually very low, it's only about 120 knots, not 850 knots like the X-15, it'll still be oscillating just a few degrees. And yet the pilot re-entered upside down. So that's the reason that we are using the feathered re-entry, because it'll support any types of either downrange trajectories. By the way, going straight down is where we get the big G's, the close to 7 G's. If we go out 120 miles and go to space and then do a reentry at an angle like the X-15, the maximum G level you see on reentry is about 4.7, okay? Because you're lifting and you're making your approach into the denser atmosphere very shallow. The drag in this configuration is extreme, and the weight is relatively light. And what that means is a low ballistic coefficient, or think of it as a feather hitting the atmosphere instead of a bullet. What happens is you decelerate much earlier in the reentry at much higher altitude without ever going to a big dynamic pressure and hitting a lot less molecules during that. So you have lower heating, you have lower stresses on the vehicle, and it's a much safer way to re-enter the atmosphere. So that's the bottom line on feathering. It is important to remember to bring it down for landing.
Notice Bert likes playing with this
model a lot. Okay. Okay. I think we should open it up to Q&A now. Is that work
yep,
for you?
Yeah, I think that's great. We could. Okay. I don't know if we can see the audience, please. And I suppose there are mics roaming around down there.
Yeah, or maybe we can walk out further where we.
Here's
can.
A question over here to start to kick off.
Oh, this is much better.
How much
out
are
here?
The tickets? Well, the tickets are starting at the moment. I mean, at the moment, this is a huge investment for Virgin, and it's a risk from the point of view of the investment profile. So the tickets at this stage are $200,000. They're not cheap. And the pioneers who are buying those tickets now are, you know, high net worth individuals. About 60% of them are pilots. The split is about 45% female, 55% male. The average age of the customers is about 50 years old. They're a very interesting group of people. A lot of them are scientists. A lot of them are entrepreneurs. Some of them are media celebrities. But on the whole, they are all people who've dreamed since they were kids of going to space. And they're all people who do believe they're contributing to a very important project here. We hope, though, within 5 years of operation, we can get those ticket prices down quite a lot from there.
White Knight 2 does not even have an autopilot or even a yaw damper. It is a hand-flown general aviation airplane with mechanical flight controls, even though it's large. So it doesn't have multiple redundant hydraulics and electronics and fly-by-wire and all of that expensive stuff that occasionally goes out and tries to kill you. So its flight controls have some longer cables because it's a big airplane, but it is essentially a cable and pushrod airplane, just like your Piper Cub or Bonanza. No, we feel the same way about that. Our company has always been one. I think we need to back up with the feedback. Say again? Is that good enough? Somebody was hollering from up there, I thought. We feel the same way about that. Our best work is doing the research and development, and we plan to continue to do that. That's why an announcement was made, a couple of years ago, that there is a production company being formed that's owned mostly by Virgin, and Scaled has a stake in it also. But that company will build its culture as a production company only. So the airplanes that you fly in, the spaceships that you fly in, and the ones that will be built for commercial use and production flight test, and the sales of those to the spaceline operators, will be done in a company called TSC, Spaceship Company. It's not Scaled Composites.
A gentleman over here. Left.
Hi, so does that mean if not this year, perhaps next or the year after, we all could get a $5 raffle ticket for a ride in space?
You know, how that's being marketed is up to the space lines. I think there's been already some very creative marketing by Virgin. In fact, if you buy $200,000 worth of Virgin Atlantic tickets, you get a free space flight. Isn't that true?
Not quite. It's 2 million miles, 2 million Virgin Atlantic miles.
Okay, I thought it was about that.
For U.S. citizens, our sister company, Virgin America, which is now launched, despite the best efforts of the U.S. government to stop it, it's now launched and operating out of San Francisco and a number of other airports like New York. It's a domestic carrier, and they announced yesterday at the rollout event that customers of Virgin America will be able to save up their miles in the Virgin America Elevate program to get a ticket into space as well. So start flying Virgin America and stop flying all those legacy airlines, and you can get a chance to go to space. I think when it comes to a raffle approach, there are actually a couple of legal issues with that, sadly, when it comes to this project. And what we are going to do is we are looking at a possibility of doing something very close to what is obviously conception in your mind, whereby we could offer a lower ticket. We've just done it recently in the UK. I don't know if any of you have ever flown out of a UK airport or some of the other international airports. There's a car company called Best of the Best where you can put down $60 towards, you know, a Lamborghini or a Ferrari or a Rolls Royce or whatever, and 1 in 10,000 people wins it. And we actually did an experiment at the opening of Terminal 5 at Heathrow, and British Airways opened their new terminal. We wanted to have some Virgin branding in there. So we took the spaceship into Terminal 5 alongside the BA ticket desk and offered people the chance through that scheme to bid for a ticket. And that was very, very popular, especially as people were so delayed at the launch terminal, which was a bit of a screw-up, that they had nothing else to do apart from buy their Virgin Galactic raffle tickets. So I think the concept of what you're saying is something that we will look at.
The sender?
It was Bert's idea.
That was the idea for the use of Spaceship One before it was deemed too important an artifact.
Okay. Center here?
The Smithsonian historian judged that its historical significance to the future commercial space was similar to the historical significance of the Spirit of St. Louis to airline travel. And so when that happened, Paul Allen called me up and said, you know, I don't want to risk this. I want it in that Milestones of Flight gallery for sure, so let's not fly it anymore. And I said, well, how about if we fly it a couple of times and get 40% of your money back? And he said, yeah, okay. You know, the X Prize. But it was clear from very very shortly after our June flight in 2004, when we got the letter from the Smithsonian, it was clear that we were only going to fly it to get the XPRIZE and then put it in museum.
What are the heat shield requirements?
Sorry,
the heat shield requirements at Mach 4 are actually quite small. If that vehicle had no thermal protection at all, it wouldn't put it in danger at all. All it would do would be to damage the outer ply on a very limited amount of the structure, the nose and leading edges and of the flying surfaces. It would have some damage that you'd have to repair, but it wouldn't put anybody in jeopardy. So we're going to do just what we did with Spaceship One, and that is to cover the leading edges, very small portion of the airplane, with a insulator that can have a little bit of charring, but it'll actually last probably 100 flights before it needs to be replaced. So it's not a maintenance issue, it's not a cost issue, and it's definitely not a safety issue.
Center right, way in the back.
Won't both the aircraft have to go through a regular FAA certification process the way any new commercial aircraft does? And if so, won't that add a lot of cost and delays to the whole program waiting to get certified?
Oh, absolutely. Doing a conformity program like a Part 25 certification program would pretty much add so much cost to the introduction of these that it would be prohibited for any of the folk who are investing in this now. There's an additional problem, and that is there is no such thing as a Part 25 that applies to these. You can't apply airline requirements to a spaceship. I mean, some of them land on rockets, some of them land on runways, some of them land on parachutes. So there is no such thing as a Part 25 to certify it to. What the FAA set up in the law that was put in place in 2005 is that we can't put in certification requirements, and we won't try to put them in for the next, 8 or 10 years, something like that. And that you'll have to then develop these based on the operations of whatever your system is. And in the meantime, the FAA's primary obligation is to protect the non-involved public, but to have the people that fly them and the passengers that fly in them, fly them under informed consent about what their safety history is and under a liability waiver. So that's what's in place at first. And what it means is we don't have to go through the conformity process. However, we do have to make them safe. And our approach on that is to not do a conformity package, which then allows you to build hundreds of airliners without doing testing. What we're going to do instead is do a significant amount of testing on each ship that comes out of the factory to prove that that airplane by itself is safe to fly within its operating limitations. So what that does, it's a more appropriate scenario if you're only going to have 40 built. It's not an appropriate scenario if you're going to build 400 or 4,000 spaceships. And I think eventually we'll have, once these requirements are defined, and they're only defined by operational experience, that's what Part 25 and Part 23 are, almost everything in there that's a requirement has come because of a specific accident that required that requirement. So I think eventually you'll see a similar certification to airliners, but it's something that won't work initially, and that's the solution to it.
Down front left.
Hey, Bert. Because you're going to be flying out of commercial spaceports/airports, you're naturally probably going to run into issues that we as pilots run into every once in a while, where the runways not clean for us to land on. Are you going to be implementing a go-around/relight capability in the spaceship two aircraft?
Okay, first of all, the commercial launch license for your spaceship is not a license only for the spaceship. It's done in conjunction with the spaceport, okay? Now, the spaceport itself has very specific requirements that make it so that there is not going to be a Cessna pull out in front of you on landing, and that there's not going to be, if you have crosswind risk, then you need two runways, and all the requirements are to fit what your safety needs are. So they're actually combined. As far as doing a go around, no, we're not going to have a go around. We do have a throttle, and we do have a lot different changes on the touchdown scatter than we had with Spaceship One. But like the space shuttle, it does not have go-around capability. That would probably give you, a go-around capability would mean you'd probably could only carry about half the number of passengers to space. So it'd be very expensive on your revenue and on your operating costs to be able to do that.
And the first purpose-built spaceport is gonna be in New Mexico, just near the White Sands base. And that's got cleared airspace anyway, and it has been since 1945. And it's a dedicated runway for Spaceship Two and White Knight Two. We're looking at other locations around the world, and we take this very point into consideration with those locations. We look for locations that have cleared airspace for one reason or another. So Kiruna in northern Sweden is another location that we're looking very closely at the moment. And Kiruna in northern Sweden is an excellent location. You could fly people into the Aurora Borealis, which has never been done before, and I think it'll be very cool. And you'll also, from that location, they have cleared airspace for their small spaceport that they've got there. They've got a runway which doesn't get a huge amount of use during the day, so there won't be a go-around issue there either.
Now keep in mind, when you launch, the first thing that you say to the tower before you launch is you ask for landing clearance. That's a little unusual. That you start your flight by asking the tower for landing clearance, and he clears you to land before you let go of the launch airplane. Okay. Now, we're going to operate it very much like we did with Spaceship One. We have multiple runways. If we have a direction, if we have a big crosswind come up while we're during that half an hour or so that from launch to landing, okay, and that's about the time period that it is, about 30 minutes. And we also have lake beds and alternate runways along the path, so there's a whole bunch of things that are required for a spaceport. A spaceport cannot be just a single runway. It has to have these other safety elements.
Center?
Yeah, I have two questions, one and then a follow-up. First, what are your feelings on pilots? Are you going to insist on using all military pilots? And if not, how do I apply?
I'll answer that on the Virgin Galactic side. Obviously, Bert has a team of dedicated scale pilots who will be undertaking the beginnings of the test flying program. We've got a chief pilot for Virgin Galactic now called Captain Dave Mackay, and he's a typical Virgin Galactic pilot. He's currently a commercial airline pilot. He's a Virgin Atlantic captain. He's been a military fast jet pilot, and he was a test pilot. He qualified at the Empire Test School in England, and he's flown various types over the years. All of the pilots that we've currently got in the first cadre of Virgin Galactic Space Line pilots all have this combined military fast jet experience and commercial experience. And actually having the commercial experience has been very helpful to Bert and the team. It's been quite useful them having somebody who's come out of the commercial airline business and is thinking about passengers in the back rather than just thinking about test flying a vehicle. So that combination of scaled working together with pilots who've got, yes, good fast jet experience, but also this commercial experience. And that's going to be pretty much our model for the future. We will be looking for pilots to join Virgin Galactic. We're recruiting the first American pilots from Virgin America. So we've already got the first two Virgin America pilots. They're both former military pilots from the US Air Force as well. And again, they've got this commercial experience on top.
The pilots will also be selected among that group of pilots who don't have a history of flying while drunk. And also, unlike an airliner, there is no barrier and locked door between the cabin and the crew. The windows up front are also nice ones to look out of. We don't want to put a net or a barrier. So during the weightless time period, the co-pilot's duty, whereas the pilot has very few duties during the weightless time period. He gets a feather up and then that's about all he does is control attitude. So the co-pilot will turn around and it's his responsibility that when this nice young lady starts floating towards the pilot's lap as he pushes her away.
Okay. The quick follow-up.
But anyway, you will be in an environment where you're not in the back out of the action. You will be right there watching the pilots do their job of piloting a spaceship to space, and we think that's an important part of the experience as well.
Okay, one quick follow-up, and then there's a young lad who wants to ask a question.
I would be in serious trouble. My wife and I are fascinated with thinkers, and Bert is one of the great thinkers in my lifetime and many of ours. I think we can all agree on that. There's a lot of logic that he applies to things that no one else seems to. And I have to ask, how do we invite you to Thanksgiving dinner?
I couldn't hear that. Sorry, we couldn't hear that.
How do we go about inviting Bert to Thanksgiving dinner?
We couldn't hear that. We can't hear you for some reason.
He wants to know how to invite you for Thanksgiving dinner.
Ah, well, Bert or me?
Well,
or both.
I've learned a long time ago that there's three things that you never turn down.
Yes.
A free meal and a ride in an airplane.
That's great.
That's a good combination.
Center right.
From my understanding, the more thrust, the higher and the faster the White Knight 2 goes, the less thrust that the Spaceship 2 needs. What were the decisions for the limits on the White Knight 2?
As it turns out, that is not true. The White Knight, because it is a more powerful, more high altitude capable launch airplane than what we had before, we took Spaceship 1 just as high as we could take a fully loaded Spaceship 1. With afterburners on, and we clawed our way to 48,000 feet. Initially, we thought we'd be launching Spaceship 2 at about 56,000 feet. But as it turns out, the spaceship has to make this turn with its wing. Okay? We're not launching it, you're dropping it. And if you go into thinner air, the spaceship doesn't do as good a job at making that initial pull-up, and the apogee, the space altitude you go to, turns out to be not as good if you launch higher. Another problem with launching higher, and your comment about can you use lower thrust, if you use lower thrust and do a less aggressive boost, you end up flying out of the atmosphere with the rocket motor running. And that means that your elevons and rudders are not effective, and you have no way of controlling attitude. So Spaceship 2 and Spaceship 1 are not complex rockets that have nozzle vectoring control. They are airplanes with rocket thrust. Now, once you're outside the atmosphere, you have redundant reaction controls, little puffers that let you change the attitude. But if you were to launch higher with lower thrust, you'd end up not being able to control the attitude on the last one-third of the rocket burn.
I've got your young man down left.
How fast is Spaceship 2 going to go?
How fast is Spaceship 2 going to go?
It's going to go Mach 4. Four times the speed of sound. It'll also go higher than Spaceship 1.
We only have time for a few more questions. Quick reminder, we have been told on good authority that the buses are still running, okay? Don't blame us.
Another one on down left.
If your objective be to go distance, and if you go that high, how far you can go out? And is any possibility you can go up and just go long distance? Or how much the earth move when you go up in the weightlessness? Is the earth moving under your the wing or not? Or you are moving with the earth like an airplane?
Well, I think our ambition, this system itself does not have the capability for a long downrange flight for the spaceship.
It can only go about 150 miles downrange.
But it's a very good question. Our ambition, I mean, it would be logical to think that Virgin Galactic's ambition, as well as being a space line of the future, is actually to be able to develop a system. If we can make a commercial success of this, which we're very confident we can, we want to develop a system later on that can take people from continent to continent, from spaceport to spaceport. with a downrange capability of several thousand miles. So, you know, semi-orbital flight on a long parabola. So as you could get from, you know, Los Angeles to Sydney, Australia in 3 hours, for example. And that will be the one of the goals of the second part of our program from Virgin Galactic's point of view, once we prove that we can make a commercial success of this.
The physics of it, though, mean that it can't be a rocket glider like these are. For example, if you boost to a speed so that you can get to Sydney, Australia, and then do a parabola to get there, you would go 4 or 5 times as high as the space station, and you would enter the atmosphere so sharply that you couldn't survive re-entry, okay? The other way of doing it is to go to the very top of the atmosphere, just barely out, and rocket this way. If you did that to go to Sydney, you'd have to go to almost orbital velocity, and you would spend most of your time getting there decelerating in the atmosphere. So it's not practical. It is practical if there's propulsion breakthroughs and development done to have an air breather operating at above 100,000 feet. Then you could have an airliner that can go Mach 5 or 6 and go to Sydney. But it's not anywhere near like something like this.
Senator?
No. Yeah, given the during the press conference yesterday and what you talked about tonight, launching from multiple sites, and that you need to have airspace cleared, the FAA is very slow in doing commercial spaceports. How are you going to work on getting them to move faster?
Well, I mean, we have one civilian spaceport already in the United States in Mojave, and the process is well underway in New Mexico. The state of New Mexico is very advanced. It's done the design work. The spaceport has been designed by Foster and Associates, one of the world's leading architectural firms, and the environmental work has been done with the FAA at the moment, and they are pretty confident they can have a spaceport open in New Mexico for regularized flights by 2011. I think that's the last question now. So thank you very much, everybody.